You are listening to episode number 89 of the Secondary Science Simplified podcast. Y'all, it has been such a fun month walking through my curriculum design process with you, but I don't know about you. I am personally ready to switch gears. Tomorrow is August, and for most of you, August means back to school season. I want to spend this month talking all things classroom management with you because of that. So I decided to kick off this month's theme of podcast PD with a guest interview. I have a lot of things that I'm personally excited to share with you on classroom management, but as most of you know, I haven't personally been in the classroom full-time since before COVID. So I have no idea what it has been like for you all as you attempt to manage a classroom full of apathetic post-pandemic students. And so I knew I needed one of you to help me. So I sent out an application to my email list, and I was amazed by how many of you applied. I truly was so humbled by your responses to my call for help. And honestly, it was hard. It was hard to just pick one of you to interview, but I think you will understand why I decided upon Casey after you hear our conversation today. So Casey is a fourth-year science teacher at Sumner Fredericksburg High School in Iowa. He teaches biology, anatomy and physiology, chemistry, earth science, and astronomy. And so if you're doing the math and realizing that he's a fourth-year science teacher, then you know that he has had the most wild teaching experience these last 3 or 4 years. So get ready, because in this episode, he shares such great advice for reaching apathetic students, and he answers all of the questions that you all submitted to my Instagram. So we talk cell phones, bathroom policies, cheating, and so much more. Casey is incredibly wise, and I was genuinely inspired by our conversation. I cannot wait for you guys to hear it. Let's get right into it. This is Secondary Science Simplified, a podcast for secondary science teachers who want to engage their students and simplify their lives. I'm Rebecca Joyner from It's Not Rocket Science. As a high school science teacher turned curriculum writer, I am passionate about helping other science teachers love their jobs, serve their students, and do it all in only 40 hours a week. Are you ready to rock the time you spend in your classroom and actually have a life outside of it? You are in the right place, teacher friend. Let's get to today's episode. Hi, Casey. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm so good, and I'm so grateful for you joining me. For everyone listening, I sent out a SOS on social media and to my email list, and I was like, I need someone to come on who has taught in the classroom in these pandemic and post-pandemic times. And Casey's one of the people that responded, and your experience is wild, and I can't wait to get into that. But before we do, why don't you just introduce yourself and tell listeners just kind of your background in education and your teaching experience and all of that.
Sure. So my name is Casey O'Hearn. I'm actually going into my fourth year in education. Throughout those first 3 years, I've taught biology, chemistry, anatomy and physiology, earth science, environmental science, eighth grade science, and next spring I'll be teaching astronomy. So it's a lot of preps. I've taught at two different schools. Both of them were small public schools in Iowa. I have a Bachelor of Arts in biology teaching with endorsements in chemistry and earth science from the University of Northern Iowa. And next year, I will begin working on my master's in science education.
Wow. I mean, that is a lot of preps you've done in 4 years and two schools. I thought for sure you were going to say you've taught at a private school. But I guess, I mean, because normally when you have that many preps, it's private. But you said they're small public schools.
That is true. Yep. Public schools in Iowa. So.
Wow. Okay. So why did you want to be a secondary science teacher?
I always knew from probably about elementary school that I wanted to teach in some capacity. There's just something about being able to, you know, pass on knowledge and skills to another person and watching as they become adept with those skills. As for why science, though, interestingly enough, I actually started off as a music teaching major. I wanted to be a high school choral director, but I kind of looked back at all my choir and band and orchestra directors from my past and just realized that they were all like miserable, balding old men. And I did not want that to become me. So I chased my other
path. You have a great head of hair from what I can see on Zoom. So you're not going down that path yet.
Thank goodness. My other passion though was science. So I changed my major to physics. And then while I was working on that degree, I took an introductory biodiversity course and just fell in love with biology. So changed my major once more, and here I am.
Did you still graduate in 4 years?
I did not. It was a 5-year program, and I actually graduated in 7 because I changed my major a couple times and was taking a bunch of other stuff. So it took a while.
Well, hey, I bet all of those changes have helped you teach all those different preps.
It did help. It did help. Yes.
Okay. So what would you say your favorite has been to teach, and what's been your maybe not so favorite so far?
My favorite, I actually figured would be biology, but turns out it's chemistry. Mm. I really enjoy teaching chemistry. Although anatomy and physiology is good too, but that kind of depends on the group I get. I either get students that are really excited about it or students that really don't care. And that kind of changes from day to day. I have to say my least favorite though would have to be earth science, not necessarily because of the content, because I actually love earth science, but because I've been kind of strapped for materials and kind of flying by the seat of my pants for that. But hopefully that'll change coming up here, because I'm working on getting my curriculum together and more organized. So,
yeah. Okay. So for your chemistry class, is that a required course? And then is anatomy like an elective? Because I think that definitely changes the dynamic of your students in your class.
Both are actually electives.
Okay.
But since it's a small school and it is me and one other science teacher, we don't have a whole lot of options for electives. That's why I'm teaching astronomy next spring. I want to kind of open that up. I foolishly volunteered to do that. because even though they're electives, it kind of turns them into required classes because they don't really have any other options. Mm-hmm. And it kind of sucks because, you know, chemistry is hard. And I got kids that are getting into chemistry that really, it's not doing them any favors. You know, they need to have something a little more their speed. So I'm hoping that astronomy course will help open that up a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I need to know too, are you helping with any extracurriculars? Are you doing any of the music stuff, or how can you do anything else besides teach all those preps?
Right. Yeah. I don't actually help with any extracurriculars. I try to go to a lot of the show choir things if I can, and concerts, but no, I really haven't had any time to, every time something's come up, I've been like, yeah, no, I'm going to wait a couple of years until I have, you know, things.
Please find someone else. Do you have a good relationship with your admin?
I do. I think our principal, he started actually the same year that I did, we've got a pretty good relationship and he's very supportive. So,
okay, that's awesome. All right. So you're about to start your 4th year, or you just finished 4?
I'm just now starting my 4th.
Okay. So your first year then was 2020?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
But the 2019 to 2020 area was when I was in my student teaching.
Okay. So that was your student teaching. Your first full year is 2020, 2021.
Correct.
Then year 2 is 2021, 2022, which is like supposed to be adjusting to normal. And then this last year. Okay. So you really haven't had a single normal year.
Nope.
Just tell us what that has been like. Like, you don't even know what normal is.
Right. So the interesting thing is it really didn't shake my world too much because I didn't have a normal before it. You know, so essentially what it's basically ended up being like, there was no expectations, no routine to be broken. So if anything, year after year, the restrictions on me have been decreasing.
That's true.
So it kind of feels like I'm getting more and more freedom. But during that first year when it was very, very restricted, I was also at a small school. I won't say where because, I'm not going to mention the school, but it was definitely the worst year of my life. Mm. I never felt less self-assured and more in need of validation that I had chosen the right career. Mm. I had no support from my colleagues or in my admin. The mentorship program there was a joke. My predecessor left me almost nothing to work with. So there I was being thrown into a new school, first job, COVID regulations. I had 5 preps, no support, no materials, and only half of student teaching experience because I lost my second placement due to COVID. But yeah, and then in addition to that, half of our students were online and the other half were in person. So technically I had 10 preps because as we know, you know, except for admin, apparently prepping for an online class is not the same as prepping for in person.
So true.
Yeah. So and I literally stopped taking attendance after about the 3rd week because it was impossible to keep track of who was supposed to be there and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. Parents sending kids in, pulling them out. Fundamental lack of discipline among the students. For a year, I thought that's just how kids were. Mm. I don't know what it is at that school, but yeah, it was rough. I had to social distance my classroom, which meant seating students in the lab, which resulted in many broken drawers, broken sinks. Half of my sinks were broken by the year. One of the faucets was bent at like a 90-degree angle. I don't know how they managed that. Well, not a day went by that wasn't sworn at, had something thrown at me. It was awful. if it weren't for like literally two kids, I reached two kids. I remember mm-hmm. their names, like two kids that I reached. I probably would have quit that year. But yeah, then I went to 2021, 2022, my first year at Sumner Fredericksburg, where I'm at now. Mm. And here I got to experience overwhelming support from admin and my peers with a really good mentorship program. It's still a small school. I've got four preps this upcoming spring. I'll have five with astronomy. But yeah, it's been a little bit better. But the COVID restrictions being lifted, you could definitely tell there was some excitement about it. But in addition to coming back to things going back to normal, this kids were still kind of in that COVID mode. And they're mm-hmm. used to being able to just go home whenever they want. And they'll call their parents and their parents will call them out of school for no reason, which is kind of weird to me. You know what I mean?
My mom, like, I rode the bus home. So I'm like, I remember, you'd be at school, unless you had like 104 fever, you were staying at school.
Right. Yeah. My mom wouldn't, if I called my mom and asked her to let me go home, she would have laughed at me and hung up probably.
100%. So I'm like, I remember missing school like once in high school. And I think it was when I had my wisdom teeth pulled. Like,
right.
It's just crazy how things have changed. So the reason I wanted you is because I have not taught in this type of setting. And so people have asked for a classroom management series and I'm going to do one. And I'm going to share what I think is kind of like universal strategies regardless. But I'm like, I need someone to speak specifically who has taught in this. And that's why you're here. So I would just love to know what you could share. I think teachers are drained. It's mainly because of those apathetic students. Like you were saying, if it hadn't been for those two students, you may have quit. And it's so hard to keep going when it feels like every student is just so not interested and just doesn't care. And so, and first of all, I want to say, I'm so glad, even if it was just one student, like that makes a difference in that student's life. And so, right. I mean, we can all look back and think of one or two teachers that changed our lives. So I'm so glad that you were there for them and they were there for you. But what would be your advice just right off the bat? And we have a bunch of questions too for my audience. But before we get to that, if you're going to tell someone else coming into education right now, what would you say? Like, how do we manage those students who are just like so over it?
So I've actually found it very rare to have students who literally cannot be interested in the content, especially mm-hmm. in science. Like, I don't know, when I was in school, science was everybody's favorite subject. Now I actually have people who say, I don't like science and it bothers mm-hmm. me. But anyway, the main issue seems to be that there's other things that they'd rather be doing. So I've found students would rather turn off their brains and literally do nothing than do something that they're unmotivated to do.
That's a great point. It's not that the science isn't interesting. It's exactly what you said. That's they just would rather not use their brain at all.
Right. But the thing is, like, finding that source of motivation, getting them to become motivated can be a challenge, right? If you can find their source of motivation, you can mitigate their apathy and get them to engage in the lesson. Every student is motivated by different things. Like, some are motivated by mastery. They have to know exactly what they have to do to get that 4.0. Some of them are motivated by discovery. You know, they're really interested in learning new things. Some of them are more motivated by connection. So like, they need to know that you are invested in their success and that you care. And if you show them that, that will be enough to motivate them. But, you know, finding each student's source of motivation can be a challenge. It can take all year or multiple years to get to every student like that. But my tip would be to find the biggest influencer or a group of influencers in the class. Every class has them, even the quiet classes. I've noticed there's that one person or group of people who have everyone's attention most of the time. If you can find that student or that group of students, like, source of motivation and motivate them, they'll motivate the rest of the class for you. So you'll still have a few outliers. But the thing is that when everyone else is working, you can focus on those outliers and find their source of motivation as well.
I think that's a great strategy because it can be really overwhelming when you're looking out at a class of like 30 and you're like, where do I begin? Like you said, because you're like, I know it's all about relationships. We all do. But like, where do you start? I think that's so wise to be like, okay, look for the ringleader or ringleaders and start there. And then, like you said, if the mass follows them, then you have those other outliers that you can then kind of zoom in on. I love that. That's super practical.
It's worked for me so far.
Yeah.
The other thing that I'd say, and it just kind of comes naturally to me, and of course, any science teacher, because if you teach science, you're excited. You like science. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I haven't met somebody who teaches science who doesn't enjoy it. But being visibly excited about it and being, if because I found that when I get excited or hyped up about something, like when I start teaching about evolution, I get really into it, and that is contagious. Your students will pick up on it, and then they will find themselves getting excited about it as well.
It's so true. I mean, I used to always say I'm pretty introverted, but I can be outgoing. Like I can be social, but then I just go home and like have to go into like a sensory deprivation room for a little bit. But I'm like, so much of teaching is like almost like being a cheerleader. I felt like amping myself up, especially for those classes. It's really, I'm thinking about like when I was at a very large public school in this big city and I had like 30 students in my like lowest level biology course, and they just like don't want to be there, but the bus brought them to school and they're sitting there. So their motivation is just to get to the bell ringing, you know? It was like, okay, but if I'm like up here and I'm fired up, they all thought I was crazy, but then they paid attention. I was always looking for like the next thing to do. And this isn't everyone's personality, obviously, but I mean, I was standing on lab tables. I was, you know, skateboarding in a pencil skirt in physics, like doing whatever it took to get their attention. Cause then they at least were like, she's wild. I want to at least watch what she's doing. Or like you said, she's excited. It totally makes a difference. And when you come in, you're like, okay, it's macromolecule day, my least favorite, you know, or whatever, like you got to rally that energy. And that's where I love to, like, if there's a topic I don't like teaching, I'm like, I'm going to find a resource or something from someone else or something that'll make me excited to do it so that they will be excited about it. Like, that's where I love the hunt. I love, obviously, I love writing resources, but I love like the hunt for resources because it's like, let's make this fun for everybody. It's a lot of work though when you're doing it for five preps.
Yeah, it does. You know, you kind of pick the ones to focus on and the other ones kind of fall on the wayside, you know.
100%. Okay. So some of the specific questions from our audience, one was like cheating. I feel like cheating is rampant now, especially with like moving to online stuff and then coming back. Like, and they're all just so industrious. Like they have so much access to everything. So what would kind of be your advice about how to deal with cheating and all that now?
One of the biggest things is we live in a world now where everybody has a device in their pockets that they can look up anything. So we kind of have to change how we design our lesson plans. Instead of having a focus on things like vocabulary or things that someone can find with a simple Google search, we need to focus more on making them scientifically literate, making sure that we're working their critical thinking muscles, right? Things that they can't just look up. And just, and not, I'm not saying that there's, that we shouldn't do vocab or anything like that anymore. There's a place for it, but it, I just think that the focus needs to be shifted off of it because memorization isn't something that we need to be teaching these kids anymore. When it comes to things like tests, because I noticed that there's definitely a lot of cheating on tests, I kind of ended up getting away from that because I actually don't really give tests anymore. Main reason is we have a pathetic 40 minutes of class.
Oh my gosh.
Very short class periods. So I would only have three or four students finish like a summative assessment in time. And I'd have to like bring them in later and like have them finish, which was just crazy. So for summative assessments, I give projects typically that take multiple days or weeks to complete. And you can't really cheat on a project if you design it correctly. If I do have to give a test, I usually give it in the form of frequent short quizzes throughout the unit. So like I'll take, if I have a big test that I use, I'll just chunk it out into those quizzes. And what I found is that it vastly decreases test anxiety. And if there's less test anxiety, there's less need to cheat.
Yeah.
Because you're not so worried about it. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure kind of thing. Now, if I actually have a student who does cheat on an assessment, I do make it a big deal. I tell it's a zero for now. Parents are contacted. They will be given the opportunity to reassess because I think the important thing is not punishing them, but making sure that we are assessing, making sure they're meeting the standards. So they will be given the opportunity to reassess. But for me, they have to have everything that they were missing turned in.
Yeah.
And usually that's what I point to. I'm like, well, yeah, it's like you had to cheat, but did you notice also that you didn't turn in all of these assignments? That's probably why. And I also usually give them some form of extra work that can tell me that they're ready to reassess instead of just winging it.
Yeah, I think that's great. I love the idea of projects. I remember encouraging a lot of teachers who would email me during COVID and especially even 2021, like that year after, and being like, you know, will you put your tests, you know, in Google Forms? And I was like, no, because I don't think you should be doing tests, especially with virtual classes. There's literally no point that you cannot make sure it's authentic, an authentic assessment. And so I'm like, I don't really like to grade anything for accuracy unless it's done in the classroom. Like I don't even really like to do homework, which that's a tangent for another day. But I love the idea of like eliminating tests if you can. But then if you have them, like Chris Kessler, I don't know if you know him. He's a curriculum writer and a former middle school science teacher, but he like wrote a blog years ago all about how he's always done open note tests. And I thought that was insane. But nowadays I'm like, I get it. Like, not like if you can't beat them, join them, but kind of like, if you're so tempted to cheat, then let's make it open note for everybody. Especially with your 40 minutes, you're not going to have time to like read every single thing. But it also, his whole point was like, it motivates kids to really like do their work, because then they can use all of it on a test, which I love that strategy too. So I think there's lots of different ways people can handle it.
Well, with open note tests too, because I've done those before, there's ups and downs to it. But a big plus side to it is that, yeah, one, they focus more on their notes, mm-hmm. which is good. And two, it gives you the opportunity to write deeper test questions, mm-hmm. things that aren't so much recall where they can just flip through their notes and find the answer, but where they have to use their notes as a knowledge base and answer a new problem.
Right.
It kind of opens up the way that you can write tests. It does make grading a little more difficult because multiple choice with an open note right. test is kind of pointless. But
yeah, there's no point.
You know, but
totally. Okay. So another question is, how do you manage teaching students who need a challenge, but then you're also like mediating those loud attention getters? Like, how do you balance all these different personalities in your classroom?
So this kind of ties back into my tip for teaching the apathetic students. Pinpoint those loud attention getters early. And make them your buddy. They will manage the class for you, because they're usually the instigators that cause all the problems and all the behavior problems in the class. So if you become their buddy, they will kind of manage the class for you. And that frees you up to provide deeper challenges for the more dedicated students that are just trying to work and might need a bigger challenge. And the biggest thing that I can say with this is that I learned very quickly at my first year at that horrible place. Don't get into a power struggle.
If you
get into a power struggle, not only will it make your life miserable, but all other classroom management goes out the window, because it's just focused on just you and that student, and you're going to lose regardless. Even if you win, you lose in that situation.
You're so right. I'll never forget someone telling me those power struggles are like a game of tug of war with the student, and your job is to drop the rope. And this is so hard for me, because I am like very black and white. I have an extremely strong like justice meter, and like things need to be fair and I need to be right and I need to like convince this student. But it's like, once you get that student who's like in that power struggle, like you said, you can't win. You cannot win with that student. And so it's about, someone told me the other day, this is parenting advice, but it really applies to students. Like, sometimes, Rebecca, you need to choose the relationship over being right. And I think that's the same in this situation, those power struggles. Like, retain the relationship with that individual student, but also with the class, and just show like, I'm not going to engage, because a lot of those kids are just like picking a fight, you know? And I think you're so wise to say that, but then also like take them under your wing, give them a job. Like, if they want attention, give them attention, like get them up, get them to help you with the demo, get them to, you know, wipe off the whiteboard or whatever. I think that's really, really wise advice, Casey. I would say too, with the students that need a challenge, I loved, because especially I feel like if you're at a large school and you're listening, a lot of times like you'll just have like general biology and honors. And that general is anywhere from like a kid who might be honors social studies English, but not really great at math and science, but they're just in this general class, to like kids who are in credit recovery, you know, because so like the range is crazy. Mm-hmm. I love getting those students that need a challenge and they're finishing faster to help me. Like, hey, there's 28 people in here. I literally can't help everybody. If you finish early, I'm going to send you over to this table and like you start helping them and we kind of work together. I think you're so right to like utilize them. You're only one person. Like, utilize your students to help you. I always tell even my kids, I'm like, there's one mommy and there's three of you. So I need you to help our family because I can't do it all.
That's good. Yeah, no, I'll have to use that with my own kids.
Yeah, seriously. I'm like, it's always... it all the time. Like, and I'll hear my 5-year-old now, I'd be like, there's one mommy and there's three of us, so we have to help. I'm like, that's right.
There you go.
It's so funny. Okay. Another question I got for you was, again, like this, you know, kind of you mentioned, but anything else on how to get students to find meaning in school and not just skip class?
Right. The age old question, right? That's one you get every single year from students. You know, what is the point of this? When am I ever going to use this? Well, it's becoming more and more difficult due to parent apathy, I've found, because I've got parents who will just call their students out of school and give them excused absences just because their student asked them to. I literally have students call or text their parents during school to say, hey, mom, can you call me out? And they're like, yeah, sure. And then they just call him out. Like, what? Why? But yeah, like we were talking about before, my mom would have, oh man, she would have been so mad. My best advice would be just form connections when you can. The more positive a relationship you can form with a student, the easier it's going to be to motivate them to show up. And the easier it's to find wit. And especially those students who are skipping, like sometimes they're skipping because they really feel completely lost and they might not have anybody else. If you form that connection, that might be the motivation that they need to get there and to get to school.
That's so true. And I would say too, like you need to form a partnership then with like your vice principal, your counselor, whatever, to like get these kids to school, because like it can become a truancy issue. And that's where I think it's like, this doesn't have to all be on teachers too. Let's partner with them. Like it's the counselor's job too, to make sure these kids get the credits to graduate. And so it's like, they got to be there in order to do it. So I think, yeah, like you said, it's all about the relationship, but at the same time, you don't have to like force this on your own. Get some help. Cause it's like you said, if it's a parent issue and you can't change all of them too. Right. So, all right. Another thing is cell phones. Like this is like the age old question. I feel like since probably like 2012 when people really started having smartphones. So what would you say, like, what's your best advice or how do you personally, I think sometimes it just helps for people to hear like a lot of different ways that people are doing it just to see like if something lands. So how do you handle cell phones?
So cell phones are actually, I feel like one of my biggest triumphs. I can't wait to hear them. And it's kind of the opposite of what people think. So cell phones are kind of the biggest pet peeve among my colleagues. They cannot stand them. And as such, they have intense policies and procedures centered around cell phone confiscation. So it seems to have become more of a vendetta against technology than a way to actually mitigate the distractions. And I believe that it's having the opposite effect. Immediately, when you impose these strict, harsh policies, students are put at odds with their teachers. And this inhibits your ability to form those positive relationships. So cell phones, like you said, like in like 2012 when smartphones really became a thing. And before then, even like when I was in school, like middle school, you know, every once in a while, you'd have a few students who had the flip phone. And like, if you had a phone, it was like, oh my gosh, you have your own phone. Wow.
The Razor.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The Razor. But now cell phones are a part of everyday life. It's hard to imagine somebody without one, almost to the point where they're a part of our identity. So trying to fight their presence is futile. Like you're fighting a losing battle. You're trying to change the flow of a river. You can redirect it. You could dam it up, but eventually, given enough time, that river is going to win. So my solution is don't make it such a big deal. Don't put yourself at odds against your students because of cell phones right away. I have, believe it or not, I don't have a cell phone confiscation policy in my classroom. I don't have one. And we often use them in class for labs and activities, but my students do know it's my expectation that they're not on them while I'm providing instruction, things like that. So far in the I'm not counting that first year because those students were a nightmare. But my 2 years that I've been at Sumner, I have not had to confiscate a single phone. I have never had to give more than a gentle reminder. So I've given them a reminder to put it away, and I've never had to remind the same student twice in the same class. So I think trying to outright ban cell phones is a mistake, in my opinion. So instead of leading the war on phones, what we should be doing is teaching good cell phone etiquette. You know, teach students not to look at it while someone's talking to you or while walking, or not answering it during a conversation or during class, things like that, because it makes it less of a battle and more of a just educating them.
I think that's a really unique perspective. I never thought about like teaching them proper etiquette, because I was thinking the other day, I was talking to a friend. And then while we were talking, she looked down at her watch and I could tell she was reading messages while we were talking. And I was like, wow, that was pretty rude. But like, that's interesting, because it's just like, but we're so used to it and we're so easily distracted. That's an interesting idea to think, let me teach you how to use this. So what do you say then? Because I'm already thinking, well, I can already see myself being like so enraged by like going over a lab and then I send them out and someone was on their phone, they weren't listening. And then they're like, well, I'm confused. What do I do? How would you handle that then? If you were like, I know you were distracted by your phone, this is your fault. Can you see my justice meter?
Yep.
Like, I'm getting like angry about a hypothetical.
So I actually have had that happen once. And it usually happens in the first, like within the first couple of weeks or first couple of labs or something. And it's actually pretty much that exact situation. She was looking at her phone. She wasn't paying attention. She didn't get any of the lab information that she was just like, what am I supposed to do? And I was like, I don't know. Figure it out. And she was just asking everybody else. And like everyone was like doing their best to kind of help her without telling her exactly. I was so proud of them because I was like, oh my gosh, it's like you guys aren't just giving her the answers. And she never did it again. Okay. She made sure anytime I was talking, boom, her phone was face down on her desk, like away from her. So you will have a few things that crop up like that, I've noticed. But after they get into the routine of knowing when it's okay to use their phones, when not, it's fine. So like when they're doing independent work time and stuff in my room, I let them say, listen to music or something like that. And if they're working on something, you know, and they like take out their phone and change a song, whatever. But I make sure to pay attention to the students who, like, if they do take out their phone and it stays out and they keep looking at it and they keep looking at it, that's when I go over and give them that reminder. And instead of making it a confrontation and being like, hey, put your phone away, you know, like that, because that, again, is putting you at odds with the student, right. I turn it into a redirection. Like, hey, do you need help with this problem? Like, what's going on here? What's your thinking on this? And then make them explain something to you. And then the phone's away, they're talking to you, and there's no confrontation.
Casey, you seem so patient to me. I'm like, can I just like absorb some of your patience through the computer?
I try to be.
That's amazing. I'm like very impressed. No, I think that's really interesting. I will say when I was last in the classroom full time, I had a strict policy, but I would say it was effective because it was a school-wide policy. And that was what made it effective. Like, so I wasn't the only person. It was a school-wide thing. They had a certain amount of things and they had to get the phone taken. And it was like, so that made it easier. I think I would probably do what you did if it was not a school-wide thing. Right. So I like that because I think you're right. It's like hard to be the only one like enforcing something if it's not like, or it's hard for kids too if every class is different. I don't know. That can be
because you don't. It kind of it mixes up their expectations. Like, oh wait, this is this class. I can't have my phone out at all. Or it's this class. This teacher's a little more lenient. You know, stuff like that. Yeah. Or what my principal says is like, with some school-wide policies are good and effective because if you don't have it school-wide, you know, if you're not the jerk, everybody else is.
Right.
So that's actually kind of my situation right now. Cause since we have autonomy in our classrooms and we can choose what our cell phone policy is, since mine is easily the most lax, everyone else is a jerk and I'm not. So I feel kind of bad sometimes.
No, it gives you a poor. Hey, I was one of the only teachers that didn't do homework. I didn't assign homework,
right.
But my whole point was it motivated them to be really present in my class because they knew I was going to give them enough time to do it if they paid attention, but if they didn't, they'd have to have homework. And so I feel like it's like you build some, like, hey, you respect my time in the class, I'll respect yours outside of class. You know, obviously that wasn't for like AP bio, but like for the other ones. And I felt like it was really effective. Kind of like a follow-up question. You mentioned 40-minute classes. Do you have like a bathroom policy or how do you navigate that with such a short class? I'm like, y'all, you don't have time to go to the bathroom.
It's definitely rough. I don't really have a bathroom policy. It's like prevent them from going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes you just got to go. And like, you know, so, but I do have because one of the biggest problems at our school is the flocks of girls going to the bathroom at the same time. So I have two passes, a boys pass, girl pass, and they can only go if there's a pass available. They don't have to tell me, they just get up and go. So there's, it mitigates interruptions because they don't have like, you know, raising their hand. They just have to go, but they have to take the pass with them. And if the pass isn't there, they got to wait for it to come back. Mm-hmm. So that way they can't go in groups. Occasionally I'll have one that's like, oh, it's like, I was like, I really, really have to go and try to slip one past me. But I stand by it. And then magically when the pass comes back, they don't have to go anymore.
So. Right. Yeah. I did something similar except for I just had one and it was right at the front. It was like, cause kind of like my whiteboard was like on the way out the door, it was in the corner. So it wasn't like super disruptive, but it was obvious everyone could see it. And I actually would have them just like jot their name on the whiteboard just so I would know who is out of the room. Cause like you said, I just don't want you asking, like you're in or you're out. And I can only, but I just did one out at a time because it was easier for me to keep up with them. And I found that really effective. But I think the easiest thing with bathroom too is like, if you keep the class going enough, they don't want to leave.
Right.
Like, cause they know stuff's going on. I feel like it's when they get bored that they're just like, okay, I'm going to like go to the bathroom or whatever. But like, you know, if things are moving, they're like, I don't want to leave because I don't want to miss something.
Right.
You know? Okay, another one was someone asked, what are your go-to effective policies or procedures? Or do you have any like classroom maybe rules that you're like, these are a couple things like we always do?
Well, I mean, my very lax cell phone policy would be my most effective one because I haven't had any issues with phones. Other than that, I mean, we do bell ringers, prime times, so to speak.
Woo!
So that way they know that's a policy. They come in, they sit down, they start working before the bell rings. Because of the 40-minute periods, you know, I'm got to use the time as effectively as possible. So there's a policy that they will be counted as tardy if they're not actually sitting down and ready to go when the bell rings. That gets them in and ready to go immediately. Gives us a little bit of time there. Other than that, I don't really have a whole lot of rules in my classroom. Again, I feel like rules are very restrictive and, again, puts you at odds with the students other than, you know, the obvious rules. No bullying, no talking while the teacher's talking, things like that. Yeah.
Don't hurt someone.
Don't hurt anybody. Don't eat things in the lab.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
Most common question I get, can I eat this? No. Yeah. No, you
literally
cannot.
No. Do you let them eat in your class at all? Like up at the desk?
It depends. If it's a distraction, no. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it's not. Yeah. And I tell them that. It's like, I'm fine with you eating, but if you're like coming in and like opening up a bag of chips and all I hear is crunching, like that's going to be really annoying. So please don't do that. Or like if you bring in like a full plate of spaghetti or something like that, like you can eat, but as long as it's not a distraction.
Can it not be like a tuna melt? Yeah.
Yeah. And they have to be in the classroom area. I don't allow any eating or drinking in the lab.
Right. Of course. I never let food just because most of my time teaching our lab space was our desks. You know,
right. Yeah.
Except for my AP bio class, but I had them first period. So it was like, and they were older kids. They're just coming in with like coffees and stuff, but they were great too. Cause they always knew to like clean their table before and after, and they were easy, but yeah, I think food can be a tricky one. Okay. Two more questions. And then I have my final question for you. Someone asked, what do you do about students who just flat out like refuse to do any work?
Yeah. So I actually have a few of those. And I've tried multiple things. The one thing I found works the best, I try to give them smaller tasks within their assignment. Because I like to provide time in class to work because same, I also don't give homework. I give them time in class to work on things so that they can ask questions.
Yeah.
And then I'm there to answer them. So often I'll have a student who sits there and just doesn't work. So what I'll do is I'll frequently visit them and give them smaller goals. Like it's like, let's see if we can get 1 through 3 done before the bell rings. Right. Often when I do that and I'm basically redirecting them and essentially forcing them to do something, that's when they bring up the questions. That's when they have these questions that they had that they were too nervous or too embarrassed to ask earlier. Very rarely have I seen a student that's just lazy. More often they're just lost or they're confused and they're afraid to ask for help. So if you can coax out their questions and help them to understand, that can typically get them working because to them, it's just easier to just give up and just sit there and do nothing than have to ask these questions that they might think are stupid questions.
Yeah. I think that's great. I love grading for completion just to be like 10 points, do this. And just to even get them, because I think even a little bit of points, I hate grading for accuracy, honestly. But I feel like if you're able just to get, because that will help some of those students that are just like you said, who just don't want to do anything, just get going. And then, like you said, I love the bartering. I love like I love like doing a private deal with a kid. Like, hey, just give me the odds and I'll like, I'll spot you the 10 points. Like, come on. Cause you know, some of those kids, like you said, like some of them, and then I find it easier too, because then those kids, you know, who do have like an IEP or 504 who need double time, I just give them half the work, half the problems. So then they get double time essentially. And I think doing this on a one-on-one basis is really helpful. Okay. Last one from the audience was just dealing with those shortened attention spans. Now that kids have tech, they're always like every 5 seconds, they want to do something else. Or like you said, they'll zone out and then all of a sudden they're on their phone and you're like, what are you doing? So how do you keep their attention?
Well, feed into those short attention spans, right? Mix it up. Mix up the sequence of the class. Like I said, in our 40-minute period, I never lecture for 40 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
The only time we spend 40 minutes on one activity is if we're doing a lab or something along those lines. And those are interesting enough to keep them busy. But like I just like to keep them busy with varied tasks and activities and get them up and moving. Like so they're not sitting in one spot for 40 minutes.
Yes.
So
I
find that helps the most just to keep them engaged and keep them from getting distracted.
Yeah, I think that's great. I have a little like freebie. I'll link it in the show notes for anyone listening. It's like, I call it like the anatomy of a class period, but it's basically how I like divide up a 50-minute class period. And then the second page is like 90 because I've taught both. And I do the same thing. I'm like, you got to switch it up. Like it's got to be moving. And I think the hard thing is, and then people are like, well, then you waste time in the transitions. But it's like, well, you can train them to transition more quickly because like you said, that's, I think like a theme of this episode that you've articulated so well is just like, don't fight them, go with them or like meet them where they are. Don't fight the phones. Don't fight the attention span, like work with it. I think that's really wise. Okay.
Thank you.
Last but not least, I like to ask all my guests, and I feel like I haven't had a guest in a while, so I haven't gotten to ask anyone this in a while, but I would love for you to share one way you've simplified your life recently. And it could literally be anything. It could be school related, or just like, since it's summer, maybe something you're doing at home with your family or anything, or maybe something you've stopped doing. What's one way though that you've been simplifying your life, Casey?
Well, back in college, I used to run all the time. And when I started teaching, I kind of stopped. But it doesn't really seem like a way to simplify my life because I'm adding something or adding something back. But I started running again. And it really does simplify my life because of the amount of stress relief I get out of it. While I'm running, like, nothing else really exists. You know, I'm focused on my breathing. I'm focused on my pace. And all the tension and the stress and everything from the day just kind of disappears. Right now, I'm actually doing a challenge run to run the distance from the Shire to Mordor from Lord of the Rings.
That's awesome. How far is that?
There's 5 segments to it. I'm actually not entirely sure what the total distance is. So far, I've made it as far as Bree, which is about 230 kilometers. So my next step is to get to the Doors of Durin, another 150 kilometers there. So.
Okay, so when are you running in your day? I think a lot of teachers are like, I know I need to exercise, but like, how do I fit it in?
It honestly depends on the day. I prefer to run in the morning, but sometimes I'm not a morning person. So it really just depends. I just try to squeeze in when I can. If I've had a particularly stressful day at work, immediately when I get home from work, I run. You know, it helps that it can be tough, especially with kids.
Mm-hmm. Can you throw any in a stroller? Are they small enough to be in a stroller still?
Yeah, I do have a running stroller. But man, that adds a lot, makes it very difficult. But
yes.
I do not have a double running stroller, so I'd only be able to bring one of them. Mm-hmm. Luckily for us, my wife works weekend package as a nurse.
Oh, nice.
So she's always home during the week. So it's easy for me to go for a run at that time. But then on the weekends, I can't because it's just me and the kids.
Right.
No daycare, but you know, shift parenting it sucks, but it makes it tough to schedule things sometimes.
Yeah. I'm like, there's pros and cons. Like, it's great because you don't have to worry about daycare, but hard because, yeah, you're all on or all off. Yep. Well, I think that was great too. Just the idea of like, sometimes adding something is simplifying, like you said, because it's creating space to like quiet your brain or moving your body helps so much with stress relief. I always do a lot of exercise postpartum for my brain. And I remember my oldest with the last baby was like, Mommy, we got to do our exercise today for your brain. I'm like, I know, got to get my brain cells back because it's like so centering. And it's nice to like, at least when you have a newborn, you know, check something off the list. Like, oh, I did something besides keep humans alive today.
Right.
You know, that's a big accomplishment.
Yep, that is a big accomplishment.
Well, I'm super grateful for you coming on here. I think this was a really helpful episode. I don't know if you want my listeners to stay connected with you or not, but if you do, how can they reach you?
Yeah, I guess if you just want to throw my email into the show notes, that'd be great. I'd be happy to answer any questions people have or just bounce ideas off of each other.
Great. I'll do that. I'll link that in the show notes. Well, thank you so much, Casey. I really appreciate it.
Perfect. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode and my interview with Casey. You can find all links mentioned in the show notes at itsnotrocketscienceclassroom.com/episode89. All right, teacher friends, that wraps up today's episode. If you're looking for an easy way to start simplifying your life as a secondary science teacher, head to itsnotrocketscienceclassroom.com/challenge to grab your classroom reset challenge. And guess what? It's totally free. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll see you here next week. Until then, I'll be rooting for you, teacher friends.